My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
You may have missed it, but the final debate in the Conservative Party of Canada's leadership race took place Wednesday night. If you did miss it, well, don't feel too bad. You were far from the only one.
Well, I can tell you there's no place I'd rather be right now. I'm told that I could have, instead of being here with all of you in Saskatchewan, I could have...
That was Pierre Poilievre, who over the past several months has gone from favorite to front runner to basically all but a done deal to become the next leader of the Conservative Party. And if he doesn't feel like he needs to be there, it shouldn't come as a surprise that not too many people even noticed the debate was happening. So has Poilievre really sewn this thing up already? If he has, what does that mean for the Conservative Party and its direction? What does it mean for the Liberals and the next time we go to the polls? And most importantly, what could it mean for Canada? Because whether or not you support Poilievre and the Conservatives, he has some big plans should he find himself in the Prime Minister's office. And if he does, the millions of Canadians who put him there are going to be expecting some radical changes. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. David Moskrop is a podcaster, a columnist, a political scientist, and the author of the ever more relevant 2019 book, Too Dumb for Democracy. Hello, David.
Good day. And I have to say, former Canadian political, well, sometimes Canadian political scientist, because, you know, like a true masochist, I occasionally now am writing academic stuff for fun. For fun.
Yeah, that's unique.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Why don't you start by telling me about the final Conservative Party leadership debate that happened Wednesday night? What kind of affair was it, and why didn't we hear more about it?
I was going to ask you. I didn't watch it because, in part, it's a little bit like playing a Stanley Cup final game after the cup's been awarded. You know, Poilievre and Lewis decided to sit out the debate. They sat them around a table inside a studio with no audience. I was catching up on the news about it this morning. You know, maybe it's more like, you know, like a band without its classic front person. You know, imagine like Talking Heads without David Byrne and you get Tom Tom Club.
Well, why wasn't Pierre Poilievre there? At least let's start with this. Why wasn't he there according to him speaking at a rally?
Well, according to his campaign, he wasn't there because the debate was being held during the get out the vote period. And it was far more effective for campaigns to be focusing on going to meet their people and getting out the vote than it is to be sitting around and debating, which they've already done twice. I guess three times technically with the unofficial debate. And you know what? Okay. I get that. That was the official reason from the campaign. It just wasn't the right thing to do. There were better things to do during the balloting period.
Put on your political strategist, political scientist hat just for a minute. What about unofficially? Why would Pierre not go to this debate?
I mean, if you've won the war, why would you poke your head out into a sniper's alley?
Has he won this war? This race is over, is it?
I think it is. And I think a lot of people think it is. And I think the numbers confirm that it is, both the fundraising numbers and the memberships sold. Now, it might not be in the sense that the ballots haven't all been marked and returned. So it's entirely possible that those that are out there still could go to someone else. The numbers could change if something cataclysmic happened. But I think if you're a betting person, and I don't bet on politics or sports anymore for that matter. to borrow an old Norm Macdonald joke, I don't like my bookie anymore. But if I were to bet on it, I would say, you know, the smart money's on that it's over. And so Pierre Poilievre has there's no upside for him to show up at a debate where he's going to reach fewer people probably than if, you know, he went out and saw a crowd. And that's what he did yesterday. In fact, he made sort of an offhand remark when he was in Saskatchewan that, you know, why would he sit around and listen to a former Liberal premier talk about a carbon tax when he could be meeting people? Pretty good line. Not particularly kind, but it hasn't been a kind race.
We'll talk about his pretty good lines in a minute here, because that's a big part of this campaign. But just to focus on the race, such as it is, you and a lot of people think it's over. Was it ever not over? I mean, back when Patrick Brown was also in it, there were kind of thoughts that he and Jean Charest could team up and take down Poilievre. But it really kind of has seemed like his to lose from the very moment it began, right?
Yes, I think it was from day one, he was the presumptive favorite. I don't think it was a coronation, though. It wasn't a fait accompli before it even started. In fact, there was an awful lot of talk about the resistance from Charest, the resistance from Brown, the fact that Lewis was surprisingly competitive the last time she ran. She could be again. You know, maybe Roman Bauer would dilute Pierre's support a little bit. And so it was a proper race in which different competing factions with different competing ideologies and perspectives on conservatism were having it out. And so it wasn't a coronation in the way that, say, you know, Justin Trudeau running was more or less a coronation, or for that matter, before him, Paul Martin. Mm-hmm. Those were coronations. This was not a close race in the end, probably, but it wasn't quite a coronation. But I will say the fact that, you know, Poilievre has been the favorite from the start and seems to be the favorite right to the end says that he was always the powerhouse candidate. But what it doesn't say, what it doesn't pick up, is the fact that there was an ideological debate happening in a way that you often don't see in other parties. In fact, the conservatives, I would say, are more, at least expressly, ideological diverse within the narrow world of conservatism than, say, the liberals are within the centrist world, or even in some cases, the NDP within the left world.
Let's talk about that for a minute, and maybe you can explain that ideological debate and what does it say about or mean for the future of the Conservative Party of Canada that Poilievre has now seemingly at least run away with it.
Well, to oversimplify, you know, for the purposes of this, because nobody wants a lecture, there are two general camps you can look at within the leadership race, the sort of old, what you call red Tory, a kind of somewhat, you know, socially progressive-ish, economically slightly statist, but still business conservatism in the red Tory mold of Joe Clark and a little bit Brian Mulroney and, you know, on the way back to John Diefenbaker to some extent. That's a sort of old Tory style that we saw for decades, and that was pretty much wiped out when the Alliance Party came to dominate conservatism and then became the Conservative Party anew. And on the other hand, a sort of libertarian-ish, populist pastiche conservatism that you saw a little bit of in Stephen Harper. I wouldn't call Stephen Harper a populist, but there was sort of that, the remnants of the prairie populism that was part of the Reform Party and Preston Manning in the 80s and 90s. And the sort of libertarianism of get government out of your lives, cut, less government, less taxes, let people do what they want. Except if you're Pierre Poilievre, who supports the dairy lobby and supply management, in which case there's a big old asterisk, a big old gatekeeper that he likes. But those are the two general camps. And you saw Lewis and Poilievre and Bauer in the one, and Acheson sort of in the middle, and Charest and Brown in the red Tory side. And those were the two general camps. And they were having it out. And that represents a debate that the Conservative Party has been having internally and sometimes split apart for decades. And that's continued throughout this race. But it seems, in this case, the kind of libertarian populist pastiche that Poilievre has picked up is going to carry the day.
Well, because you mentioned it then, I'll ask you, Stephen Harper came out and endorsed Pierre Poilievre. What does that mean? And were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. And it's long been known that Stephen Harper is not the biggest fan of Jean Charest. You can read all about that pretty much everywhere. They've got a beef that goes back a number of years. They're also very different kinds of conservatives. Harper is the father of the modern, the contemporary, I should say, Conservative Party. And no doubt he had an interest in seeing it survive unified in the mold in which he created it. And that's no doubt but why he came out in support of Polyev, who is in many senses the standard bearer of that type of conservatism. And, you know, Aaron Wary wrote a pretty good piece in CBC about how Harper was passing that populist torch. I keep doing this P alliteration.
I know the passing of the populist torch is not great for podcasting.
It is not. And I feel like I've, you know, adopt this sort of like Spiro Agnew-esque thing that I did. So God help us all.
I had seen some people likening this to Donald Trump kind of taking over the GOP with, you know, fiery populist rhetoric, et cetera, mostly linked, I guess, to Polyev's YouTube videos and popularity on social media. That seems not right to me. Like, on the one hand, people want to see this as a really new thing for this party to be this rhetorically aggressive, I guess, but Pierre Polyev is a long-standing conservative MP. Like, he's not coming out of nowhere to upset the apple cart.
I think that's true. He is not an outsider in the way that Trump was an outsider. But also, was Trump an outsider? He wasn't a longtime politician, member of the party. He's sort of been donating to both parties for some time, but he was still an economic and political elite. Mm-hmm. And so is Pierre Polyev. And so in that sense, they're slightly dissimilar in the party membership loyalty sense. Polyev is very much a conservative and has been for a very long time. He's consistent on that. I don't think he's cynical in that sense. I think he's cynical in other senses. Trump was different, but they're both elites. And, you know, Pierre Polyev has been an MP for years, since his 20s. He has a pension from his service. That means he's been around a while. He's, you know, more than secured that. And he was a cabinet minister, for God's sake. So he's an elite. But where they're similar is that they've taken aim at what Polyev would call gatekeepers. So they have taken aim at the traditional elites as part of the problem who need to be taken down. Incidentally, something the left also does, but in a different sense. So you've seen on the sort of right-wing version, the elites are government, politicians, people who stand in the way of cutting to a smaller government and more freedom, quote unquote, for the people. On the left, the elites are, you know, corporations, robber barons, economic elites who are out for the interests of themselves and the shareholders, not the masses. So in that sense, you know, Polyev has picked up this populist pastiche, but his target is different than a populism that you'd see, for instance, on the left.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.
When we spoke to Shannon Proudfoot, then bureau chief for Maclean's, about Polyev, who she spent a decent amount of time with, she kind of drew out two sides of him. You know, the aggressive flamethrower with the good lines that we talked about. And then also, you know, the student of political history, the guy who knows how politics works and knows how to get things done, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people have been saying that Polyev is taking this tact to secure the leadership and that he will move to the center once he wins. Do you think that there is a moderate inside him?
No, I don't. I will say, if you're looking to understand Polyev, Shannon's piece is a very good place to start. And she's a remarkably talented journalist. And she was able, as she often is, to draw a lot out from him and his politics and put it in context. So, I mean, I think that piece is a great place to start. I wouldn't conclude from it, or any other piece for that matter, that we can say, well, this is simply a leadership gambit. He will moderate. I mean, he might. And I think to some extent he may have to because of the nature of our system. But I wouldn't say that you're going to get a fundamentally different Polyev as leader of the Conservative Party or prime minister than we have now. He believes what he believes. To the extent that he'd be moderated, It would be by the fact that he has to deal with, as leader, you know, a caucus, MPs, senators, party officials and opposition, other opposition parties in the government, or in government, he's got to deal with, again, the caucus, the opposition, the courts, the premiers, other countries, and the people of Canada, and so on and so forth, who to whom he has made significant promises that he was going to have an awfully difficult time keeping. So I do think the structure of the state and the reality of being in a leadership position, which is much more difficult than running for it, would temper him a little bit just by necessity. But I still don't think that would mean he would give up his program. And I do think he would remain a combative politician because he's always been a combative politician.
Right.
I don't think he's going to win and become a great unifier all of a sudden because he's in this position of power. I think if anything, he probably doubles down on it, even if the rhetoric does become tempered somewhat and the limits of what he can do become apparent.
What is it about that program that has people either concerned or, frankly, fired up?
Well, I think first and foremost, he's speaking to a rather large constituency that is rather rightfully concerned about their present and their future. They're anxious, they're frustrated, they're scared, they're angry about, you know, making less money or making not enough money, about housing being too expensive, about inflation being a serious problem, about being tired 2.5 years into the pandemic, you know, that they simply can't get ahead and they want solutions. They're angry about healthcare. They're angry about education. They're angry about all kinds of things, probably anxious about climate. And Polyev has picked up on this and has been speaking to it in a way that other politicians haven't. And that fires a lot of people up. But the program he advances, or at least ostensibly advances, he hasn't been super detailed, but we can kind of work it out from what he's said, is, you know, smaller government, fewer services or less of it, right? He has this idea that ministers in his government would have to follow a pay-as-you-go rule. If you were to introduce a new dollar of spending, you have to cut a dollar of spending, as if government were household finance, which it's not. So, you know, there's this idea that, okay, well, smaller government will free people. And when people are free, they can go make money and they get money from paychecks, not from government, and everyone ends up better. That's where people get anxious, because there's a moment in which people think, actually, maybe government is important in our lives. Yeah, we need government now more than ever. We need it for healthcare. We need it for dental care, for mental health care, for vision, you know, to tackle climate change, to make sure that when we lose our job because of a pandemic or economic downturn, that we have, you know, a decent employment insurance scheme, that we have a pension when we retire, and so on and so forth. Say, so, okay, well, we need more government. That's not the Polyev formula. And so those who believe less government will free them to do better, to make more money, love this. Those who don't, are rightfully concerned about it. But he's picking up on the general anger across the population, including myself. I cannot stand him, but I watch his videos and I watch his rhetoric and think he's tapping into something important that other politicians haven't been able to. And it really speaks to people, and I understand why it does. To some extent, you've got to give it up, because he's done a great job at tapping into that sentiment, even though he's, you know, playing with fire.
Why is he playing with fire?
I mean, I think first and foremost, you know, stylistically, and I think rather cynically, he's adopted this caricature of himself, sort of Thatcher cosplay for the post-truth era, and it is simply productive. It works, generates lots of money, and it sells memberships.
What's dangerous about it?
Well, because it is fundamentally premised on two things. One, attack, 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 attack the Bank of Canada, attack the CBC, attack Trudeau, attack journalists. And that creates a kind of febrile animosity, or at least, you know, grows it in a very dangerous way. Because when people get riled up like that, they do things we'd rather they didn't do. Vitriol, for instance, or worse. We've seen in the United States what happens when you whip people up into this frenzy. That's point one. So that's fundamentally dangerous and norm breaking, probably. It sort of starts this race to the bottom, because now everyone's at it and you throw the norms out the window, and then what you have is the United States right now. So that's point one. Point two is he's making an awful lot of very angry promises to a lot of angry people. Now, do you think he can keep all of those promises? Can he lower the price of gas? Can he lower the price of food? Can he raise wages? Can he secure jobs? My guess is probably not. What happens when you can't make good on all those promises? What happens to those angry people then? Well, their lives get worse, for one, because you haven't solved their problems. Two, They're very angry, and now they're very resentful, and they become more distrusting, and they get up to God knows what. So there's at least two reasons that his campaign is extraordinarily dangerous, but it might work for him in the short run. In the long run, I'm reminded of a line that JFK once used, you know, those who seek power by riding the back of the tiger often end up in the inside, as Trump did, right? I mean, you can keep this up for a while, but if it doesn't work, and often it doesn't work, well, then that's it for you. That's the end of your career. And you've just left a giant mess.
Well, that brings us to the last thing that I want to talk about, which is, again, assuming Polyev secures the leadership. Right now, we're not supposed to have an election for a few years. We know that can change. But just how fundamentally different will the next election be if it's Pierre Polyev versus Justin Trudeau?
Well, there was some data recently from Angus Reid and some interpretation from Philip Fournier, who wrote a good piece about it in Politico. And the sense is, you know, Charest would probably be better for the Conservatives in the sense that he could do better in Ontario and Quebec, which the Conservatives need to win. They came fairly close in the last two elections, we forget, that had things gone slightly differently in Quebec and Ontario for them, they might have won in 2019, they might have won in 2021. They, in both cases, they received more votes than the Liberals, although that doesn't ultimately matter. But it does show the fact that they were competitive. Both Charest and Polyev right now are roughly 34%, you know, nationally is what Angus Reid suggested in their July 18 to 20 sample. So they're competitive. You know, Pierre Polyev could very much win a national election. The suggestion that the sort of takeaway, the analytic takeaway, as Fournier and others have noted, that it doesn't seem to be the case that his rhetoric is tanking him or would tank the party in a general election. So you've got to take them seriously. Keep in mind that Justin Trudeau is, you know, there's growing flack and frustration with him, and it doesn't seem to be abating. And if the pandemic goes on, I should specify the COVID-19 pandemic, we're also staring down monkeypox, and inflation continues and economic troubles continue, then the governing party is inherently at a disadvantage because they're the incumbents and it happened on their watch. And so who does the world turn? Who does the country turn to? Well, historically, they turned the Conservatives as the alternative. So, you know, Polyev could have a good shot just by default, just by being there. And that could happen any time between, let's say, you know, September, which is extraordinarily unlikely, and, you know, fall 2025. But it's going to happen, and troubles could extend to then, so, or even get worse. So, you know, there's very much a chance that, you know, Polyev, if he wins, assuming he does, will be competitive in the next election and could very well become prime minister.
How much of that would be helped by him having Justin Trudeau to face down, who obviously instigates a lot of anger from the base of voters we're talking about here? And could that be mitigated by, as a lot of people have discussed, Trudeau himself stepping down to make way for Chrystia Freeland or somebody else to sort of take a bit of that target away?
You know, there's a question I like to ask is, when was the last time a prime minister left their party in better shape than they found it?
I feel like I'm not going to like the answer to that.
Well, it doesn't really happen. You know, I think he's, you know, Stephen Harper led his party to defeat. You know, Jean Chrétien left the party for Paul Martin, but Paul Martin wasn't long for this world. We all remember what happened with Brian Mulroney, down to two seats. John Turner was defeated after Pierre Trudeau left the party, sort of limping in the 1980s, we probably have to go back to Pearson, who left the party in good shape for Pierre Trudeau in 68.
It's a long time ago.
So it's been a while. That's my interpretation. People might disagree, but I would say 68. On top of it, when was the last time a prime minister won four elections in a row? It's happened twice in our history, back to back, in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And into the early 20th. MacDonald did it, and Laurier did it.
Not a lot of modern precedent.
No, and of course, it's a very different system back then. It was effectively a two-party system, and it was very different. But it's, you know, it's a long shot. And that might be moderated by Trudeau leaving. I don't think it would be significant, especially if the heir to the prime ministership wasn't a particularly strong campaigner or fresh face. You know, that person would have to be free of the baggage of the Liberals. And it's going to be hard to imagine any front runner who is, because they've been around for some time.
Right.
So I think it's going to be tough. And if you look at the history of the country, sort of go back and map when the liberals win, when the conservatives win, there's a long history of the liberals governing for a period of time, people getting frustrated and sick of them and saying, okay, it's the conservatives' turn. It's kind of been like the case for, well, pretty much since Confederation. The liberals get tired, they get arrogant, they get incompetent. And if you look at the current state of affairs, it looks broadly similar to that that pattern we've seen in the past. And then that's the ballgame. So I think they're just sort of timing out. Maybe they'll squeeze another minority government out of this, but it seems less and less likely.
David, thank you so much for this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Moskrop, political commentator, columnist, author of Too Dumb for Democracy, and as he said, a sometimes political scientist. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Talk to us by emailing hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca. Follow us on Twitter. Click like on everything we post. We're at TheBigStoryFPN. And call us. Leave us a voicemail and say hello. The number is 416-935-5935. You can get this podcast anywhere you get them. We appreciate it. When you get it somewhere, you can leave us a rating or a review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Have a safe weekend. We'll talk Monday.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.